Episode 302 of The Pilot, The Pilot Podcast takes off now. Fly with Garmin Avionics, then grab your mobile device and make the Garmin Pilot app your cockpit companion. Get advanced functions you'll use before, during, and after every flight, including updating your aircraft's databases and logging engine data. Plan, file, fly, log with Garmin Pilot.
The Pilot to Pilot podcast is brought to you by Learn the Finer Points. Use the link below to save 10% off their ground school app. With high-resolution coast-to-coast composite radar and cloud-to-cloud, cloud-to-ground lighting updated every 2.5 minutes along with always available weather products like METARs, Echotops, and StormTracks, SiriusXM lets you fly confidently knowing that your weather information is available at 500 feet or at your destination 500 miles ahead.
I'm Brad Lehman. I've been a Marine pilot for the last 20 years. I've flown everything from Hornets, F-5s to F-35s as a test pilot. So been a little bit of everywhere and then some. I've had a pretty phenomenal Marine Corps career and aviation career.
Aviation, what is going on? And welcome back to the Pilot Podcast. My name is Justin Seams and I am your host. Today's episode is with Brad from Swing Sesh. And now this is kind of a cool episode on how we connected. But Swing Sesh is this ultimate playground, CrossFit gym, workout gym. The idea is fantastic. It is your kids are hanging out playing. Why not you go hang out and work out while they're playing? So you get to have family time. They can see you work out. And now the cool part is this company and this product was designed by a pilot. It is a Marine pilot who you're going to hear a lot about. His story is pretty crazy. And some of the complications with running a business and landing on an air carrier over in Italy can be pretty complicated. So it's one that I'm really excited to talk about. And I love sharing the entrepreneurial spirit. So I'm very excited about this episode. Brad, thank you for coming on. Wish you the best of Swing Sesh. It's a pretty cool product. Check it out. And also, if you're into it, you might want to get one because they're pretty freaking sweet. But Aviation, that's all I got for you right now. So without any further ado, here is Brad, Marine pilot, and also owner and creator of Swing Sesh.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man, I'm excited to have you on. We talked a little bit before in the DMs about what you do, and it's just so crazy how this worked out. I think I literally just liked a video, and you probably saw Pilot, and you're like, oh, let me follow Pilot. And I was like, yo, dude, your swing set is awesome. I want one of those one day. And then you're like, yeah, I'm a pilot too. And I was like, no way. So here we are.
Yeah, I'm probably one of the, I'm a one of one. You know, you can find a few astronauts here and there, but there's very few dudes that have gone from military aviation to swing set manufacturing or fitness playset manufacturing. So I think I'm one of one.
Yeah, 20 years ago when you joined the Marines, where you're like, yeah, my end game is to create a swing set where I could also work out.
No idea, but that's awesome. I'm always willing to have a good time and play along the way. So
cool, man. Well, hey, we'll get to the swing session later. We'll talk more about aviation now. So first question I ask everyone is, why did you want to become a pilot?
Yeah, so maybe a little jealousy. I don't know. But my sister, and when she was in second grade, I think I was probably five or so. She made a video called My Dad the Pilot, and I was out at the airport watching, and I had kind of sat around when he was doing some flying lessons and things like that. Just watching him do that, I don't know, it just gets in your blood. And from that, I knew I wanted flying to be a part of my life. I didn't know what that meant exactly, but I just knew that, you know, flying was going to be involved, whether it's for pleasure or for, you know, for work. So.
And how old were you when you did that? You said your sister was in second grade, but how old were you?
Yeah, I think I was like five. I was really young. I was out at the airport, you know, being managed by mom, like running around crazy.
Get back
but,
here.
You know, looking at all the planes. Yeah, exactly. Probably going where I shouldn't have been going, being dangerous. But just the sound of airplanes, the smell of 100 low lead, and, you know, the thrill of dad learning to do something that he loved. So, yeah, it was really exciting to see.
When you're a little kid and you fall in love with aviation, is it the sights? Is it the sound? Is it the kind of the smells, the whole environment? Or do you think it's more of just like, hey, that's my dad doing that. I think that's really cool.
I think it's all of the above, you know, it's you know, your dad is, at least for me, is such a powerful impact on me and my mom for that matter, telling me, you know, you can do anything. And I believe her, you know, so kind of having that influence at a young age is, you know, it's very powerful to who you become later in life. And I think that's honestly one of the reasons why swing sesh is so important to us now, because we're trying to manifest that same mentality in our kids and having a good environment to do it in. But yeah, being out there at the airport and just, you know, seeing it, being a part of it, and just thinking about how cool it is that, you know, you're up there flying around, you can go anywhere, do anything, see anything. Really cool.
So how far did your dad take it? Did he take private pilot? Did he go any farther? Or tell me a little bit more about that.
No, that was it. Yeah, just a private pilot. Then he ended up buying a share of a Bonanza. We had a V-tail Bonanza for a, you know, short period of time, maybe short. I don't know now that I'm thinking about it. In kids' eyes, it was a short period. And we would do small local travel across the Midwest. And then he sold out of that partnership and then kind of went dormant in aviation for a while. But his high school math teacher was also my high school math teacher. Kind of crazy coincidence, you know, over the years, but he was also his flight instructor as well. And, exactly. And so one day in math class, I think that, Mr. Jacoby knew that, I was bored, or I don't know. He knew I had it in me. And, he's like, why don't you come out to the airport and wash some airplanes for me? And I was like, yes. All right, I'm in, I'm down.
Manual labor, so you got me. Yeah.
Exactly. So that's kind of how it started for me. I already had another job, but at that point it was like, okay, it's on. Like, this is awesome, and I'm going to go do that. So started washing airplanes and slowly started working towards private pilot license. And yeah, the rest becomes history.
And when you were like washing these airplanes, say if your math teacher didn't do that, do you think you would have gotten into aviation when you did? Do you think it would have been prolonged even longer, or a possibility you don't even do it?
I'm sure it's, you know, man, that's a causality, you know, what happens if, I don't know. But I always enjoyed that aspect. I had another major influence, a guy that led me into the Marine Corps, family friend at the time. So I would imagine that would have still happened regardless. And then, you know, would I have had that same flight experience prior? Probably not, but, I still had that same drive to, you know, to join the Marine Corps and go from there. So I think it would have happened regardless. But yeah, luckily I was intercepted early.
I know, right? You were infiltrated early.
Exactly. Yep.
And now, I feel like most people have washed an airplane at least once, but it is not very fun. I mean, maybe you had a different experience, but you hit your head, you hit your shoulder. It's way more work than you thought it would be. Like, it's like, I can wash a car, that's fine. Get a plane, it's like, oh my gosh, this is taking forever. My head hurts, it's bleeding.
Yeah, exactly. I remember thinking, man, this is a lot of surface area on this thing. And I'm sure I wasn't making actually any money at it, but just being out there. And I do remember distinctly, it was like November and sort of gray days and cold. So you get yourself all soaked and then be cold in addition, which was never fun, but it was worth it in the end.
Yeah, so for sure. And then when you were there, so mentioned never getting, didn't really know if you actually got paid, but what was it, or what was the transition to actually like being there and going to a flight school? Was it just by happenstance of being there, seeing that flight school on the corner or in the airport, and you just walked in one day? Or was it more of you watch this airplane, the owner comes up to you and they start talking?
Well, no. So Mr. Jacoby was the instructor. So he had, you know, just a couple guys there randomly. I mean, it was a small grass field with, you know, no flight school per se, but they did, you know, very light flight training there. It was a hobby type place. So yeah, that was my initial experience.
Cool. And then
I did end up going to, go ahead.
Keep going.
Yeah. So I ended up going to flight school. So my story sort of diverges there. So I started in college as an engineer, kind of not knowing, you know, what I wanted to do, that aviation was the job per se. And I also, you know, at that point in time, I hadn't had the Marine Corps conversation really yet. So I initially went to Purdue University for mechanical engineering. And then, you know, I was going through all those courses and I just realized, like, I'm not a cubicle guy. Like, that's just not me. I don't know what I am yet. I didn't know, but I knew that was not in, you know, in my cards. And so trying to figure that process out of, you know, what was going to be next and how I was going to, you know, sort my life out, if you will. Just having conversations with folks about how they arrived at, you know, where they're at. I came across, you know, this family friend. It was like, well, what's your dream job? Like, you name it. What is it? And I was like, flying fighter jets, of course. He's like, well, what are you doing, man? And I was like, well, what do you mean? And he's like, well, go do it. And I said, this is what people dream about. That's not what they go do. And he's like, who told you no? And I was sat there thinking, I was like, well, nobody said no, of course. And he's like, well, go make them tell you no. And at that moment it dawned on me. I was like, yeah, I guess this is kind of silly. Why would you pass up on an opportunity of a lifetime? And I've been fortunate enough that I haven't had no along the way. So yeah.
Do you come from a military family at all?
I don't. So my dad was just a bit too young for the draft for Vietnam. And, you know, he didn't get selected. And I think that era was kind of a, you know, oof, glad I didn't. Yeah. So I didn't come from a military family. My dad was, just, post the Vietnam era. And, it wasn't like, a thing, you know, for our family. I know he was, you know, would have been proud to have served, would have enjoyed that opportunity, but it wasn't something that he sought out. He also had kids very young. Fortunately, so we get to hang out now quite a bit, which is cool. But yeah,
did it take any explanation? Be like, hey mom, hey dad, like, there's this military thing that I think I want to do. Were they like, you're not going in the military, or was it they were like, all right, whatever you want to do, Brad, go for it?
No, they were pretty chill about it, and like I said, my mom has always been very encouraging of you can do anything. So if that's what you want to do, you're going to do it. I know you will. So just tell me when you're done, you know, tell me how it is. So
I love it.
Very matter of fact, and, you know, gave me all the confidence in the world to succeed. So yeah, it's been a wild ride. So,
and then, so you knew you wanted to be a pilot, you knew you wanted to be a fighter pilot. That was the main goal. And you chose the Marines.
Right.
Now, when most people say they want to be a fighter pilot, they probably think Air Force, Navy. And I don't think Marines is not anything against them, but I just feel like in kind of the ranking of what you would assume that one person would go, Marines might not be at the top. So tell me how you got with the Marines.
Well, so I looked at the Air Force, and you're right. Like, it's definitely, there's a lot there in terms of flying and flying opportunities. But there's a billet inside of the Marine Corps, a forward air controller. So you get to go be the guy on the ground with the infantry that's calling in weapons. And I was like, that sounds like, wait, you're going to let me fly jets, and then you're going to let me go be a forward air controller, and then I get to go fly jets again. Like, this is going to be the most amazing thing ever. So yeah, that was sort of the selling point, from there. And like I said, I have a lot of respect for, Doug Orhood is his name, but he's the guy that kind of really pushed me toward marine aviation, but just aviation in general. And, you know, he flew helicopters in Vietnam, and his stories were just always impressive. And I thought, man, that's a really, really cool career, and I'm down.
His stories are unbelievable. Get a beer in them or something, and you can just go on for days.
Yeah. I mean, some of the stuff that they did, you know, and now, you know, we've seen that again with some of the folks that, you know, flying sorties in Afghanistan and Iraq. But yeah, there's just nothing else like that type of work. So
I probably have interviewed a bunch of Navy pilots, a bunch of Air Force pilots, even some Army pilots. I feel like the people that listen to this know the path of what it takes to be a pilot there, but talk a little bit about from zero to where you are now and what the path looks like and how you got to where you are and how you got to kind of fly in your dream planes and being and just who you are.
Yeah. So, there's always an ounce of luck in everything. So, just keep that in mind. And I feel very fortunate to have, you know, been one of the lucky along the way. So a lot of it is your work ethic and how hard you can do, but then there's this ounce of luck that no one controls. So, along the way, there have been dudes way better than me that have gotten, you know, not selected or didn't make it. And it has nothing to do with them. It's literally were you in the right place at the right time to get to that position? So just keeping that in mind as we go along. So, Yeah, I started flying, like I said, on the side before. So I had some private pilot experience going into it, which turned out to be a really huge leg up for me. They started a program after me, but it was basically after my time going through, but it was basically where you would get, you know, 30 or 40 hours in a small plane, something along those, 3 to 5 maybe is what it started. And then it turned into like 30 or 40. But they were realizing that they could get the folks that were going to get sick or the folks that just didn't like it, that they could kind of get that process weeded out right there. So you want people that are mutually excited to be in. Like if you're just getting sick all the time, it's kind of silly to spend the money training you to do something that you're just not going to enjoy. So
in an F-35, kind of not getting past make you that. Getting sick any easier. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, having that experience kind of gave me a little bit of a leg up. Then, you join the Marine Corps first and foremost, and they say, you know, welcome to the Marine Corps. You've signed an aviation contract, but guess what? You know, we'll let you give it your best shot, but if you don't make it, you're still our hot body. So just so you know, infantry's calling your name or whatever else on the backside. You're our pound of flesh until this contract is over. So you better study hard. You know, you kind of have that out the gate, which is pretty cool. But also, you know, a little bit nerve wracking because you want to go and make it happen. But I'll tell you, this is sort of a side story because this audience will probably very much appreciate it. When I graduated college, instead of getting a car or, you know, doing something else along those lines, I bought myself, with my parents' help, of course, an RV4. And I came up with a business plan of how I was going to, you know, trade this RV4 time for flight time in the future. And therefore I would be able to pay you back X dollars now. And then it would balloon loan into whatever it is. And, my parents were like, this is crazy, but we will help you. So they had to co-sign for me to, you know, to make it happen. So I had an RV4. I was building flight time in that. I was kind of parallel route just in case the Marine Corps flying didn't pan out, that I would have an option, you know, later on to go and do, civilian aviation just as a, you know, as a follow-on job. So, I guess the story is sort of convoluted here, and I apologize for no, doing it great. That way, but
I love it.
When I was at Purdue, I had that realization that I wasn't going to be an office guy, right? I knew I was going to do aviation. And once I had kind of made that commitment, I switched over to Ohio University because my father had moved jobs. And so he was resident in Ohio now, and I had an opportunity to go to a flying school. So I went over there and I finished up commercial pilot. And then I finished up, my instructor ratings for, my CFI, my MEI, and those, you know, those types of things. And I was doing flight instruction there at the university. And that happened in, 2001. And so I stayed after 9/11 because there were no aviation jobs. And I was like, oh my gosh, what are we going to do here? Yeah, exactly. And so it, you know, and that once again was like, okay, definitely Marine Corps, but I got to make sure that I get to a yes along the way, as we go. So now kind of back to
college,
joining the Marine Corps.
College was funded by yourself. You didn't do ROTC or any kind of, military funded college then?
No.
Okay. Got it.
Yeah, I did. My folks were, you're going to go to school and you're going to pay for it. You better figure it out.
So, you're like, all right, fine. I'll figure it out. Someone figured it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So I went to Ohio State.
I worked in the summers and
not too far away.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. So, after college, then I started working with a officer recruiter. And that's where I, you know, signed the dotted line. And then now that leads me back to the story that I was telling before. So, I was, I'd already signed up. It was in June of, 2004, and I was getting ready to go report to, my, you know, basic training. I was flying the RV4 back across. I'll never forget the moment because I was above, you know, light cumulus clouds, great, beautiful afternoon in Ohio, headed back to, my folks lived in Mansfield at the time. And, looking down, just like, man, I am trading all of this right now for a life that is completely unknown. I have no idea what I'm getting into. And there's a war going on right now. Like, man, is this, this is serious, you know, just having that little realization of what was about to happen. And then, you know, you just make that commitment that, you know, it's something that's worth the trade and you're going to do it. But, yeah, it's one of those experiences that I'll never forget. And then, you know, driving in through the gates of Quantico the first time, like, oh, this is real now, you know, there's no turning back. Like there's barricades everywhere. Like there's, you know, you have committed to this.
Yeah, I'm here.
And so then the next year of your life is, I did the 10-week officer training. So you go through all the standard, not hazing, but, fun drills to, you know, learn the basic, you know, what it takes to be a Marine officer. It's very physically demanding. So that's sort of the genesis of kind of my later developments now. Kind of learning that from my perspective was, you know, I grew up as just kind of a farm kid in Indiana, and I wasn't a professional athlete, or, you know, I wasn't, you know, a track star, baseball star. I was just, you know, an average kid doing average things. And then you're kind of tossed in the mix of all these folks that are, you know, now, you know, pretty good at athletes, good solid athletes. And then beyond that, now you're starting to rub shoulders with some of the smartest people you've ever come across that are kind of vying for those same positions. So that was a pretty, really, both a awesome experience and kind of humbling at the same time. And then you go through the Marine Corps, where it's kind of unique, is you go through a 6-month course called the basic course. And you learn how to be a platoon leader. So, at the time, it was pretty serious because there were a lot of folks that were, kind of getting called to action, so to speak. But we had, billets that were getting flagged as like, hey, we need somebody right now to come fill this role. You know, a lot of them were forward air control billets and things like that, while they were either in flight school or just after flight school. So, kind of, you know, you needed to learn your stuff, but at the same time, it was, hey, I've got an air contract. So, I want to, you know, stay focused on what I want to do as well. So, but that's the kind of unique difference between other tracks and what the Marine Corps does. Everybody's a rifleman in the Marine Corps first.
When you were getting kind of recruited, I'd say, or when you were meeting with the recruiter, was your background, CFI, commercial, having all this time, was that kind of advantageous to them? Do they look at that and they're like, oh, cool, we're more than likely going to put you in this slot? Or, because I know in the Air Force, a lot of times that you take a test, and if that test tells you you're good enough to go for it, then you have the opportunity to go for it. But what was the meeting like, and what was the expectations that they set for you?
Yeah. So, I would say from a Marine Corps perspective, you do have to pass the AFOQT. I think that's still the same test today. I haven't gone back and looked at recruiting in a while, but, I think that test still exists. So you do have to have high scores on that, but the previous flight experience certainly helped with, taking that test. But I think from a Marine Corps perspective, it's more of a, you know, if you have, then, you know, they're willing to work with you if you, if that's what you think you want to do. At least at the time they were, and a lot of that is just going to be needs of the Marine Corps and, you know, how many pilots they're tracking to need, and, or, you know, kind of what that rate of retention is going to look like over the next, 5 to 10 years. So if you hit the times right, then, yeah, you get that, that contract, and things work out.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. Cause I try to bring this up at every podcast. People probably are tired of me saying it now, but just the difference in what the industry is like now versus 2008 or 2010 is crazy. Like even in the military, what they're trying to do to retain pilots, what they're trying to do to make sure people are flying because they need pilots so bad. It was not always like this, and it won't always be like this. There is going to be a day where it's going to be a little bit harder to get a job. Maybe not as bad as it was back then, but there is definitely going to be a day where it slows down and where it is not going to be as easy. The money's not going to be flowing like it is for civilians or even for retention bonuses in the military. So it's really, I feel like it's humbling, and it's good to hear those stories and just to be reminded about what it could be like and what it probably will be like eventually again.
Yeah, I agree with that. And not only that, but from a lifestyle aspect, it's pretty important that, you know, there's not a day that goes by that things couldn't change drastically. And, you know, from the inside, it's, you know, I may not be here at home. I may be, you know, overseas or deployed. And then from the outside, it's more of a, you know, I have a really nice steady paycheck, but I have to be prepared for those times when it may not be there. So the pilot lifestyle is pretty phenomenal, but at the same time, it can get turned off pretty quick because it is, you know, it is from an industry perspective, it is a luxury, and it'd be one of the first things that anybody from a budgeting perspective would start to look at pulling back on travel and or corporate.
It's one of the first things flying, to go.
So.
Hey, get rid of that airplane. Why are we paying $1 million for that? You mentioned something that was interesting when you talked about getting into the Marine Corps, and that's kind of, I don't know if it's the first time, but you notice that there's people that are smarter than you. There's people that are faster than you. There's people that can do stuff better than you. A lot of people have that realization at different stages in their life. Some people have in high school, some people have in college when they leave their small town where they knew everyone. Talk about the mentality of that, where you're going in thinking, I'm going to be a pilot. And most of the time people are pretty confident. They'd be like, well, I'm the best. I can do this. Like, there's no one to be better than me. But then you start seeing other people. It's like, wow, that guy's actually really smart. How did you know? Like, I didn't know that. Or really fast. Or just doing stuff better than me. And that can affect your mentality. And you can either, you know, there's a fight or flight. You can either choose to work hard or not. But talk about how you yourself kind of handled that when you were thrown into that situation. I mean, you might have been the best. Everyone might have been looking at you and they're like, oh, we got to catch Brad. But talk about that.
No, I was quite the opposite. I was probably the bottom. So I would say it doesn't happen until you really get to your fleet squadron. That's like the hardest part. So, you know, you're going through primary. Primary is, you know, learning to fly. In my case, it was the T-37. The T-6 was online, but the T-37 was getting phased out. So I had the luxury of flying a jet as my first military aircraft. And I was going through an Air Force school at the time. So I went through Vance Air Force Base in Oklahoma. The Marine Corps had they had just instituted a policy where folks with previous flight times would go to the Air Force schools because they were different. And the way that the Marines had started, they were struggling, I think, to get pilots through. And my previous flight experience was going to significantly help kind of fix that while they stood up the program of the initial flying, in the background. So that's why, I ended up going to Vance Air Force Base. It turned out to be an experience. I had, you know, great instructor there. I'm sure that everyone's experience is the same. It's all of the schools are built to ensure that, you know, you have the capacity to succeed. It's up to you to actually make it happen. But yeah, you study hard, do what you're told, and then in the end, if you have done your due diligence and your work, then it all pays off. But you do have to be willing to kind of put those extra hours in. It's sort of the difference. You know, I tell people all the time, you know, I could study 4 hours and I could get to an 80%, no problem. But now I have to study another 4 hours to get to a 90%. And then I have to study another 4 hours to get to like a 92%. Okay. But the guys in these classes, they're starting at 100 and they're coming down, right? That's, you know, it's not about what you could do, what you should do, what you might do. It's about what you did. And that is it. And I think that realization is where you first start to see like, okay, I got to put in that extra time to get where I need to be, or you're not going to make the cut. So seeing that that's the reality check from military aviation. It's like you either made it or you didn't. And there is no in between.
Which is, I mean, it's kind of nice. Like it's either yes or no, right? Like there's really no, like you said, there's no in between. So it's no like, oh, I could have, but it's just like, you either did it or you didn't. You had an opportunity to do it and you didn't do it.
Yeah. And then there's always various levels of that, you know, along the way. There's a lot of gouge out there as to, you know, here's your study sheets and then all of the good things to get you where you need to be. But it's an eye-opening experience in that sense. And then kind of going back to your original question on, you know, guys in the squadron. So when you get to your first fleet unit now, it's not really a school mentality anymore, right? You're part of the squadron. And I'll be honest, I was not prepared for that. Just, I didn't understand, you know, we had had before you'd had people that were attempting to train you along the way. And then I got to the squadron and some of the initial, I would say study gouge that you're given was, I took it to heart a little bit too much. And I studied potentially the wrong stuff for too long. And now I'm like, man, I was behind, and it finally dawned on me. A buddy of mine was like, dude, what are you like? Yeah, that's what everybody says you have to know, but here's where the actual stuff is in the background. Like, come look at this, study it this way. And I was like, my eyes were finally opened as to why I was as terrible as I was. And my skill, I am terrible at rote memorization, which is what that study, what that other study was like. If I have the why, I get to the why and the understanding, then it's like I know the material in and out till the end of time. And so I finally got to the depth and breadth of material that I needed to help me get to why the cheat sheet was the way that it was. But it was just kind of the way I learned things it was a rough start. I'll say that. And there's no more cutthroat place than a squadron, especially as a young guy. They take, society's best, and they separate it from 0 to 100%. You know, they get the best guy in the squadron, but the guy on the bottom, even though in society he's a 99.9, he's a 0 in the squadron. So you were trying hard to come off the bottom there and not be the 0. So I struggled through that for the first couple years. And then at the end of my first tour, I felt like I started getting my feet underneath of me and figuring out what I needed to do and be to be more successful. I share that as a, it's more of a, people think along the way that it's all happy, good. You just go fly the jet and it's amazing, but there's a ton of hard work that goes on in the background, and the pressure to succeed is high. And sometimes, you can be pretty hard on yourself, and you just have to, every step of the way, it's just like an emergency in the plane. You can't stop. You got to think and react and then make a decision. It doesn't matter what it is, just decide and act, and then be willing to, navigate from that decision.
100% agree. That can work with the civilian life too. That's not just toward military. It's like, you're going to be faced with adversity. You're going to be faced with decisions in the airplane, outside the airplane, whether you continue, whether you don't continue. And you just got to make a choice. You just got to do it. You can't dwell. You can't be in the gray space for too long. That's when the bad stuff happens. And that's when really bad stuff can happen.
Yeah. And I think in today's, there's so much data out there, so much, there's so many methods to have data to help you make a decision. And we often wait a long time to make sure that have we gathered all the information to make a good decision, when if you had made any decision out the gate, it would have been better than the continual gathering of data to 100% ensure that you made the right decision. So I think that's an interesting, it's kind of an interesting thought experiment as we continue to move into the digital age of aviation and life, for that matter.
Absolutely. And I mean, that too, in the air is huge, because indecision is a lot of time. You know, sometimes you only have seconds to correct a problem. Sometimes you only have a certain amount of time to land somewhere or to be in the right glide ratio. So that can be in all of your life, whether you're flying or not, like we talked about. So that's cool. I want to go back a little bit. When you're talking about, you went to Vance Air Force Base, you were kind of mixed in with Air Force. Was there a bunch of Marine pilots that went there with you? Were you kind of on your own with a bunch of Air Force guys? And then do they rank you with them, or are you kind of on a separate rank sheet because you're going to go a different route eventually?
Yeah, it was both, right? So you would rank in with them, but then I don't affect their selection, and they don't affect my selection. So at the end of the day, like, I was, it was the pool of Navy folks that I was graduating with at the time that would determine your fate, if you will. So how many jets were available, that's the jet slots. And then how many helicopter slots were available, that's the helicopter slots. And that's kind of how they divide it at that point in time. But it's inside of, you know, naval aviation for the Navy and Marine folks that were there in Vance. And there were just a few of us. There were probably, I don't know, 8 to 10 of us. There was only one other Marine in my class with me. And then, yeah, there were a couple of Navy folks in there as well.
What's it like getting a bunch of young kids that are Navy, Air Force, Marines all together and some egos? I bet it can be kind of interesting.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like college again, except you're getting paid, and you know, you feel like a rock star, even though you're not. You're just some dude, but yeah, it's a lot of fun, and we definitely lived it up. That's for sure.
Yeah, that's awesome. What would you say was the hardest part about your kind of your training that you're doing, and not civilian training, just your military training?
The hardest part. Studying is always a hard part. Just making sure that you're doing what you need to do to get where you need to be. There's an attitude sometimes. It kind of depends on the squadron, but it's like you have to earn your right to be here. And then there's other squadrons that did it the opposite way. Like, hey man, you're here. You're going to be the next dude unless you prove to me that you can't be. And so I think just dealing with the personality traits and things like that, there's just, you know, there's always something, just like any job for that matter. There's a lot of personalities that go into that. And then there's, you know, the rank structure that goes along with it. Understanding that and then kind of how it all mixes together, that was all new to me. So I wouldn't say I struggled with it. I don't think there was anything that I particularly struggled with. It was just hard overall, yeah. If that makes sense.
No, it makes a lot of sense. Yeah, definitely. And then actual aircraft you flew, you mentioned T-37 to start out with. What was the progression after the T-37?
Yeah, I went to T-45 down in Kingsville, Texas. So that's when you're starting to do my first integration with naval aviation now. The philosophies are different. So Air Force does more of a, you will be a pilot here, so don't mess it up. And we're going to ensure it by you working 12-hour days. The Navy kind of does it the other way. Here's a box of books. You better be ready to go when your name makes the schedule. And so when I went to Texas after that, it was kind of like, oh my gosh, this total freedom. You know, you could have 5 days off in a row where you did nothing but go to the beach and party. And then on the next day, you had to be ready for whatever sortie was, you know, your name populated on a schedule for. So you can see the challenges there. I'm certainly glad that I went to Air Force style first. It definitely prepared me better. And then I went down to Kingsville and I was like, wow, you guys were doing this for the last, 6-8 months, year. This is pretty awesome. So I'm jealous that, you had all this free time and, we're hanging out, but yeah, it was a great experience either way to do it in that manner. So,
when this is all going on, when you ever training, did you have, an aircraft that you really wanted to fly? Was there like one thing that you really, really wanted?
Hornets. I mean, hands down, like just, I knew I wanted to be a Hornet pilot. You know, it's a phenomenal aircraft. I just wanted to see what it was like to be airborne in it. Another good story. I was at Lemoore doing my, my initial Hornet training. And I just remember like struggling, you know, everything's hard because the syllabus is built for that type of individual to do it in the least number of sorties with the least amount of time. Like you barely have enough of the resources to get where you need to be. That's the cheapest way to make it happen. But I remember distinctly looking out at a dude pushing a wheelbarrow, him looking at me, and I was thinking to myself, like, God, I just want to push a wheelbarrow today. Like, I do not want to have to go try to remember all of this stuff at this moment. And I'm like taxiing by. And then I was like, dude, he's looking at me thinking, man, I would do anything to be in that jet today, flying that. So yeah, just kind of that like dichotomy of, you know, it's hard work wherever you're at. So just enjoy it while you're doing it and get it done.
It's hard to enjoy the suck, man. You know, it's like you really put in the work. And a lot of times what's funny is when it's over, the memories that you look the most fond on are the ones where it was the hardest, you know, it's like, that's what sticks
out. Exactly.
And you almost miss it to a point. I don't know if it just like rewires your brain or when you get to work really hard and that's just like a very prominent moment of your life and something that you look back on and you're fond of it, but, very relatable. Even when I fly a Citation Latitude and you'll taxi by, I got a long day. You're like, dang man, it'd be nice just to like work at that bar over there and just like make a chicken sandwich all day or make a pizza. Like, I don't want to do this right now, but so relatable.
You probably got it worse in that sense. You're like, you know, flying down to Turks and Keiko and all the fancy places. That's, you know, tough. You're like, dude, if I could just chill for a little bit, yep, it'd be great.
Yeah, we go to Turks and Caicos, and then we get an ASAP trip bringing us back up northeast, and we got to go in the snow. It's like, can we just stay, please?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Hey, Justin here. Now, if you're a regular listener of this podcast, you know we not only talk about pilot life and tricks of the trade, but we also cover a lot of ground on the airline industry itself. Why is that important? Because whether in the news or behind the scenes, the changes happening today will ultimately impact our lives on and off the flight deck tomorrow. That's why I invite you to join me for an important free webinar titled State of the Airline Industry, alongside a panel of respected experts in the field, including Dr. Jim Higgins, Professor of Aviation at the University of North Dakota, and Gary Krasnov, Financial Planning Professional and retired Delta Captain. We'll be discussing major developments reshaping the business right now, potential new shifts on the horizon, and what it could all mean for pilots and the flying community at large from a professional and financial perspective. But this free webinar is approaching fast, so don't miss out. Register today at raa.com/pilot to pilot. That's raa.com/pilot to pilot. Now back to today's episode. When you're doing all your military flying, was there a sense of eventually I'm going to become an airline pilot, or were you kind of all in military till your retirement and take it as long as you can?
Yeah, man, seeing that future has always been challenging, right? Especially for me, I'm a person of idle hands or my death. You know, I am busy. I have projects. My wife will tell you I have way too many projects, but I am just not good at being idle. I never knew what fate had in store for me. I just always tried to keep doors open. And I tried to be honest and real with people. Which is sometimes it works in your detriment, but I think in the greater good of long-term, you end up in a better spot because you were honest with yourself and you're honest with the folks around you. So, but it's hard because, you know, sometimes you play those cards early. You're like, well, you know, I'm not having the best of time in this particular assignment. So maybe I should, you know, look to go, you know, and I told somebody early that I wanted to try test out, and they, you know, they were like, are you kidding me? Like, you've been to every school known to man. You were, you know, you're like, you have a golden egg in your pocket right now. And I was like, I know, sir, I appreciate that. But like, there's just this itch that I need to go and scratch. Like, I got to try. And I'm happy for them if they tell me no. You know, if they say no, I'm fine with that. But I can't not try. So I would say along the way, you never know. Because like I said, there's that ounce of luck where, you know, you have to be trained, but you also have to be trained in the right spot at the right time. And if you're that, then you might get picked.
When talk about becoming a test pilot, talk about the process of you. Test pilots are most of the time engineers. They probably graduated from college with engineer degrees. Maybe they have whatever PhD. I don't know. Very, very smart people. I'm not saying you're not smart at all, but they come from it's like a very certain person becomes a test pilot, right? In your brain, it sounds like you have an engineer brain already when you're talking about you need to know the why and then things start filling in. But talk about someone that didn't have necessarily a crazy, crazy engineering background making it into becoming a test pilot.
Yeah, so that is true. There, a lot of folks are very much on the engineering side. But there's also folks that are, you know, poli-sci major that applied. They did, you know, they went and took some physics and maybe statics and dynamics, which I had to go and do as well to increase my applicability to test pilot school. So it's really, you know, I think you're trying to get a thumbs up from folks. So you have to have the right amount of flying experience. You have to have the right amount of intellectual capacity. And then you have to have the desirement to do it. And then you also have to have not all those really, really, really smart people applying at the same time that you applied. So that's the ounce of luck that just kind of falls in. So I was lucky enough to get selected. And then when you get to the school, I mean, it's a phenomenal school. It's one of the coolest schools that that exists, I'm sure. You get to fly, I don't know, 20 to 30 different types of aircraft. You're learning about planes, like things that you knew but didn't really like fully appreciate, and you're diving into these subjects and then writing about it, and you're learning it to a depth that you just you know, you needed a school like that to get you there. So it was very, very impressive. The instructors there were all really good. The academic professors there were, I mean, phenomenal. Some of the best people that I've ever come across. So it was really cool environment. And then you see, like, reading the names on the walls, you're like, that guy was an astronaut. You know, that guy, you're just the folks that you're walking in the shoes of. It was a really good appreciation for you know, just, you know, walking in those shoes and making sure that you don't let anybody down along the way. So,
yeah, I mean, that's something I feel like that's like really heavy on you when you're even just like walking through those doors, right? Like you can feel kind of the aura of who has come before and kind of the idea that you need to be at a certain level to match that or be better than that. Like there's a lot of pressure when you kind of have the history that people have gone through that test pilot school or become astronauts, like you said. So it had to be hard in itself.
Yeah. Yep. And I mean, it's one of those, you know, you may not make it through, but man, I'm glad to be here and I'm happy to be a part of giving it the best shot I've got. So I was fortunate, you know, I made it through and then I was assigned the F-35 program for my test assignment after that. So yeah, phenomenal, you know, phenomenal school and phenomenal aircraft. Yeah.
Yeah. When you were going to be a test pilot, so you said you were assigned the F-35, was there, I mean, you wanted to fly the Hornet. Was there a plane that you were kind of hoping you'd get, or was it just like, whatever they put me in, I'll be fine. It doesn't really matter.
When you apply to test pilot school, and you get accepted, when you get accepted, they tell you basically right there that they've slated you into and what they slate you into. So, I actually previous to that, was flying F-5s. So one of the oldest aircraft in the Marine Corps, as an adversary, which was that another phenomenal tour. But then after that, I had the opportunity to go into the most advanced aircraft. It was really neat to see that. So
what's it like going from literally, like you said, the oldest plane that you could possibly fly almost, to the F-35 that can almost fly. I mean, can do unbelievable amounts of stuff. Like, was that hard kind of deleting all the old stuff in your brain, you know, the antiquated ways of doing stuff and just pushing a button and things happen? Was that kind of difficult to get
I can fill in for you here. I can help you out. The F-5, you pilotry is still involved, right? There's still a lot of, you know, coming around the 90, you got to be careful. There's a lot that goes on still there. Whereas when you get to something like an F-35, your job is to manage a battlefield, right? And so when you start separating that out, there's the tactical portion and then there's the administrative portion. And what they're trying to do in aircraft now is to remove flying, as it is purely an administrative function, right? It is a way to get you to the battlefield, to manage the battlefield. And when you start looking at it from that perspective, they are automating every task that is not a decision for, you know, the fight. And it's a whole different way of thinking about flying, right? Because, you know, in the older style aircraft, you have to be really good at flying, and then you have to be really good at fighting and understanding the tactical, and then you still have to be able to fly at home, and then you have to know all the myriad of emergencies associated with all of that that system. So now they've kind of tried to minimize everything, where the jet in the background, through its, you know, massive amount of software and its ability to, I won't say self-heal, but to, you know, to give you, like, when you're touching the stick, you're not telling it, I want to move the ailerons. You're telling it, I want to roll at a rate. And therefore it does magic, we'll call it, to make that flight control system do whatever it needs to do in order to deliver those results to you. So if you're missing an aileron, you don't necessarily need to know, right? It's going to tell you like, hey, you've got some problems, whatever, but you're still going to move the stick and it's still going to give you something the best that it can in terms of a roll. So when you start looking at systems in that manner, it really is. And I apologize if I'm like oversimplifying this. There's probably some engineers online that are going to be like, what? That's not. But it changes the way that you really start, you know, looking at fighting and, you know, battlefield management and that type of stuff. So, there's still a ton of flying involved. Don't get me wrong. And you still have to be, on your A game. You still have to be physically fit. You're going to pull high G's. You're going to, you're going to fly fast. You're going to fly slow. You're going to do all of those things, but the automation aspect is, extremely high.
could you get back in an F5 right now and go rip it around? Or you think you'd be like, what the heck's going on?
Oh yeah. I mean, you can, I would definitely need a checklist and I would want to walk through it with somebody. but I think a lot of that is, test pilot, it sort of teaches you that you can, as long as you can follow procedures and read a book, then you can, there's nothing that you can't fly. You need to know what the risks are. You need to know what the capabilities of the aircraft are, what the expected performance is. And then, you know, you talk to the engineers, you talk to the folks that know that aircraft, and then you should be able to make it happen. So, I honestly feel confident in my ability to do the studying and do the following of the procedures accurately to arrive there.
And if you choose one or the other, which one would you choose? Yeah. If you had F5 right here and F35 right here, or even let's add the Hornet in, which one would you really just like naturally walk to?
Oh man, the Hornet's my whoopee. Like for sure. I mean, you can just get back in, you know everything about it. I spent so much time in that, and through such a development of my military aviation career. I love the F-35. Don't get me wrong. It's a phenomenal aircraft and I've had, tons of fun in it. But just from a personal enjoyment level, I really enjoy flying the Hornet. It has the right amount of pilotry to hard work. You know, the automation aspects of the F-35 are phenomenal for fighting. If I had to go to war, don't get me wrong, I want to fly an F-35.
Yeah, absolutely.
Six ways from Sunday, but
I was gonna say, what's it like flying an F-35? Knowing, because I mean, back in the day, you know, dogfight, you're like looking around, searching around, really hoping someone doesn't get behind you and you have to kind of do some crazy pilot stuff to win the day. But what's it like an F-35 knowing that the plane had the radar capabilities, what it can do? Your threats are much different. And I'm not saying your threat, there's still threats out there to you, right? But your threats are definitely different than what they are in an F-18 or F-16 or whatever it may be. What's it like knowing kind of, I don't want to say like the advantage that you have, but just knowing that maybe your margin of safety is a little bit higher in certain aspects of it. If that makes sense.
Yeah. So, that's from the outside looking in, it's completely different than from the inside doing it, if that makes sense. So you got to think that there's a whole host of, you know, 10 mission sets that you're trying to maintain or more that you're trying to maintain, some skill of proficiency in. So it's, you know, your close air support, your offensive counter air, your defensive counter air. So it's like, you know, all the, think about it like plays that you have to know, right? If we are going to go and attack, we do this play. If we are going to be attacked, we would play like this. If we're going to go support guys on the ground, we would play like this. So it's more of, studying and understanding the systems and, you know, knowing how each thing works and then knowing the expected method of employment of those things. So it's very, I won't say it's canned, but it's, you know, it is well studied, it is well thought out, and it's well scripted. And then there's the schools where they do the scripting, but that way everybody knows how to train and fight in the same manner. So you're trying to keep up with that, on each platform, and each platform has its subtleties that it's either better at or worse at or whatever. But you're training to maximize that particular platform. So, it really is platform agnostic in the sense of you have to train hard to understand all of those systems and how to fight that machine at its best.
For sure. And then, I recently interviewed, an F-22 demo pilot. His name's Raz Larson. No idea if you know who he is, but interviewed Raz. I asked him, what's a bad day in F-22? Like you're out on a sortie, you're out on a mission. What's a bad day in F-22? And he pretty much told me it's like, if your systems just aren't able to operate at their top level, like it's tough to get an F-22 in trouble if you're operating 100%. I'm guessing the F-35 is similar, but I'll ask you the same question. What would be a bad day on a mission? I mean, it doesn't have to be like war with Russia or China, but just in general, what's a bad situation for an F-35? Because you hear about F-35s, you're like, it could shoot 100 F-22s from 100 miles away. Nothing can touch it. But then you also hear F-16 in a dogfight, you know, it's a different story, all that kind of stuff. So what would be like a worst case scenario for an F-35?
Yeah, I don't want to, I'm not going to tackle that one and not out of, it's more out of an appreciation for what my fleet guys do. Right. So, As a test guy, I am going out to try to maximize the capabilities that are currently being tested for that. But there's dudes out on the front line those are the operators that are really worried about those aspects of the aircraft. And I certainly, I appreciate that. And I wouldn't want to speak, on their behalf in this instance. So, they're the heroes in that instance. My day was F-18. That's when I was, the frontline fighter. Now I can do that fight, but I'm not as well trained and well studied. And, it's a skill set that, requires constant, it's just like being a sprinter, right? If you are not constantly training, you are not constantly perfecting your craft, you're not that guy, and you can't be. And so it's the same to me right now. I am not a perfected warfighter at the moment. That's not my craft. So I certainly don't want to take away from the work that those guys are doing, because they're the ones that are maintaining that leading edge and that study, that keeping up with tactics and whatnot. So
what's the coolest thing you've done in F-35 that you're allowed to talk about?
I had an opportunity to do the first landing on the Italian ship Cavour. And that whole project was a really neat experience. Just, we were going through COVID at the time. We were going through trying to figure out if the boat could make it over and could we even make this happen. And the project itself was, it was a big project. But yeah, it was just a challenging overall thing, from start to finish, there was a challenge associated with it, and we were able to pull it off. And we did overall, the team did a phenomenal job of making it happen. And, being able to land that aircraft on that boat, that was a phenomenal experience for me, in terms of my F-35 time. So yeah, that was it.
I love it. That sounds like fun. It's crazy just to think about. Were you well received? Yeah. Was it like, oh, this is awesome. Champagne, here you go. Congratulations.
Yeah. I mean, everybody was excited that we were aboard, and that now the Italians were a part of F-35, a float ops, if you will. So yeah, it was really cool. And they had a neat experience in terms of, they've got a bar on the boat, and it was the lifestyle is not
a little bit different,
US Navy boat life. Yeah. It's a little bit different. So
yeah, you're kind of like, man, I wish I might've been Italian. That would have been much nicer to have this experience.
Yeah. In terms of boat life, they've got boat life figured out. That's so awesome. It was cool.
All right. Well, let's talk about what's on your shirt, man. Stand up a little bit so you can see the logo, cause I don't know if can see it from there, but we got swing sesh right there. This is the whole reason why we got, we figured out who each other was. So let's talk about swing sesh.
Yeah. So, swing sesh is a sort of a culmination of, honestly, it was my first squadron. I realized that physical fitness is a huge part of Marine Corps, period. So if you if you're bad at flying the jet, but you're super physically fit, you get sort of a little adder to it. So if you can sort of keep the balance just right of studying to physical fitness, to your leadership traits in the squadron, then you get a leg up in that sense. And, I was not just growing up, that was not necessarily my forte. And then I'm around guys that it was their forte now, and just learning from that experience, you're realizing, holy cow, like there is a next level to what's going on here, and I got to figure out what that is. And so, obviously you get your ass handed to you a couple times, and you're like, all right, I got to figure out what it is they're doing, how they're doing it, why they're better, and what's going on. And then, I'm going to start emulating that in my own life. And I just sort of, that's where it started for me for, just overall health in general. You're coming out of college life and drinking and just being crazy, and now you're like starting to, things are getting real, and you're seeing that there's a delta between people. And like I said, we're talking about the 99th percentile of folks that are divided from 0 to 100. So now it's a very minor delta, but the amount of effort required to cover that gap is massive. So that learning for me, I think, is kind of what led me to trying to stay in shape. And then when we had a family, I was like, man, life is going to change. how do I make all of this happen and keep physical fitness as a priority for us? You know, how do we do that? And it just like clicked one day. I was like, man, why don't we like take a power rack, and then what's the love child of a power rack and a swing set look like? And that's Swing Sesh was born. So
yeah, I'm not gonna lie, it blew my mind. I don't remember how I saw it the first time. I think it might have been on Garage Gym Reviews, which is how we kind of got connected, but I think that's where it was the first time I saw it, and I was like, oh my gosh, I need this in my backyard like ASAP. I was like, this thing is so sick. My neighbor and I, he got me, I played football my whole life, played at Ohio State. I stopped working out after it because I was just forced to work out the whole time. So I just didn't love it. It was more of like a job essentially. And when I was done with that and now I'm flying, I have a kid and I've realized that my knees started hurting. My back was hurting, felt like I was falling apart. You mentioned kind of the Delta and back in your day, you know, you can go out and drink, you can operate at a very high level every single day when you're younger. But then as you get older, it gets harder and harder and harder. Not even just drinking, just eating bad, everything along that has to go with being a pilot. And we started working out and noticed it's helped me out a lot. So this is it really solves a need, especially for someone that has a young kid that has families. Like, I think it's a genius idea. So how'd you come up with, I guess you have an idea. Everyone has an idea, but taking that idea and making it happen. Talk about that.
Yeah. So, it kind of goes back to make somebody tell you no, right? It's a philosophy that, I got it from both my parents. So, like I said, my mom told me, you know, you can do anything you want. You just got to go and do it. And my dad is sort of this, it's hard to explain, but when you work with him, like he's not gonna, there's not a lot of talking. There's not a lot of anything going on, but it's work. Right. And he'll just sit there and work. And at first you're like, man, I wonder if we could do this a little bit faster. And then the next thing you know, if you were doing something with him, he'll be ahead of you. And you're like, he's doing it slower. How is he beating me at doing it? You know? And it's just through a constant pace, just keep it going, you know, constant pressure, and never come off of it. And so you kind of apply those two work ethics together with, you know, that confidence. And it's basically, kind of the result of that. Just, there's nothing that you cannot achieve. You know, you can go and do it. You have to just make that mental commitment that, you know, we're going to do this. I don't know how, I don't have all of the answers, but I do know how to make a decision. And I do know how to execute, and I do know how to analyze the results of that decision. And if I can just keep doing that over and over and over again, then we may not be in play sets anymore, but now we're manufacturing something else, you know? And that's what I think, you know, we were willing to, you know, take what we kind of jokingly refer to it as, business school, right? We took ourselves to business school, the School of Hard Knocks, and we're either going to get a master's with a profitable business, or we will have paid for a graduate degree in the School of Hard Knocks. And it is what it is. Luckily enough, so far we've been able to succeed, and this thing's really starting to take off for us. So, it's a wild ride and a lot of fun.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, a lot of people have ideas, but, they keep putting barriers in front of themselves and saying, well, I can't do that. You know, I don't know how to do CAD drawings. I don't have any connections with anyone in the industry, but it's as simple as just reaching out, right? Like, I'm sure you just Googled it. It's like, all right, how do I do this? I want to make sure I do this. And you read from there and you kind of go from there, right?
Yeah. And I challenge myself, and I do this with physical fitness, and I do it with just like my own internal dialogue, if you will. There's sort of three voices in your head. There's you, the conscious one that can make a decision. There's the sort of the subconscious voice that is the will generate 1,000 excuses and try to help you be lazy and keep the inertia of whatever you have. And then there's the other dude that's just literally pulling the levers, right? That will, no kidding, shut your body down if you exceed one of the thresholds. And very often people don't, they listen too much to this other voice that doesn't have any real bearing on anything. It's every fear, every inhibition, every reason that you shouldn't. And then they don't push it to the other guy that's got the levers, man. Like, hey, I'm going to run, and I'm going to run today until the dude with the levers pulls and shuts down. And honestly, I can't even get there, because this guy keeps getting louder until you're like, all right, I've had enough, you know, yeah. I've had enough. I'm not David Goggins, so don't get me wrong, but
carry the boats. You know, come on, man.
Yeah, exactly. But it's, you know, you have to have a understanding of risk and an understanding of risk posturing, but at the same time, you can't be in fear of execution, and you certainly can't be in fear of failure. Every failure is an opportunity to pivot and learn. And if you can do those two things, then you almost can't fail, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Your goals change, right? That's honestly the reality. Yeah. Like you can't fail, but your end goal changes as you keep working. And you might find another venue that you would rather do, or maybe it works out. So yeah, just work hard. You're not going to regret the hard work you put in, because it's going to take you somewhere, or at least you'll just have a good story to tell at a bar or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that is it's a whole nother series of stories in and of itself. You know, I was actually out on the Italian ship when our first powder coater, they called, they had gotten bought out, and we were, we had orders out and we were waiting on them to get powder coated. And he's like, yeah, the guy had bought us out and he bought our oven, and we have to drop basically all the clients except for him. And that's where we're at. And, you know, the wife calls me, I'm on the ship, there's nothing I can do about it. And I was like, well, just call every local powder coater and see if anybody can do it. And then if they can't, I guess I'm going to learn how to do some powder coating. And there was no one, is the bottom line. There was no one that was willing to take us on in short order and meet our date. So, I came off the boat, and in 4 weeks, I told my dad, I was like, Dad, I need you out here. We're going to build a powder coating oven. I'm going to wire the barn up for three phase. We're going to set up a compressor, a sandblasting booth. I got to go get all the equipment, and we're going to make this thing happen. And inside of 4 weeks, we had set up our powder coating business, and we're powder coating and finishing, out of our barn. So it was, you know, and it's just one of those, like at that point, like you cannot fail. Like, you know, we could have given up, I guess, but it's just, you have to continue, you have to press, you have to get to yes. And then now we have a powder coating business that we run in addition to Swing Sesh, where we also help folks do prototyping. And, you know, if they have a project that they're trying to get started, we offer them some guidance and help to do that, because we know how hard it is. And we know what it's like when you run into, some of those no's along the way. So yeah, it's a wild ride, but yeah, you just keep doing stuff. And the next thing you know, you're
doing it.
Totally different position. Yeah.
I want you to give me kind of like the 1 minute elevator pitch type deal, or maybe like the shark deal. Like you're on Shark Tank and you give them the pitch. Hello, sharks. Like that, all kind of stuff. But because I think pilots are almost perfect for this, especially in the situation where you have a kid, where you have kids, because as we've talked about, being healthy and being a pilot, they kind of go hand in hand. Like you need to be the best version of yourself at all times. And it's very hard to be on the road and eat. You can eat really bad. You can get caught up in the go fly and go to the bar and have a beer afterwards. And that's not good for you for weeks on end. So being healthy, and I think this is such a good option for people that have the ability. They can't make the excuse that they don't want to spend time with their kids, because hey, guess what? Your kid can go on the slide. They can't make the excuse of not going to the gym, because hey, guess what? Hey, you can just get a bar and you can go do some squats. Or you can just do body weight. You can do pull-ups. You can do dips. You can do whatever. Ab roller, you don't need that. You just got to swing. I didn't even know that was an option until I saw a video of you guys like pretty much doing abs with a swing. I was like, that's genius. What am I doing? So give me the 1 minute, unless I just gave the elevator pitch for you, but go ahead and give me an elevator pitch of why someone should buy it.
I'm going to flip that, right? So I'm not going to sell it as, honestly, from our perspective, like the way I view this is, you have a why in the road, right? Parenting is one of the most difficult times of your life, period dot. Like it's hard. It's hard work. The kids are hard. It's busy. You have to focus on a lot, and you still have to, you know, do your job or you know, be the best mom, be the best dad. And now you also have to find time for self-care, and we have all of these distractions, you know, computers, and our lives are more sedentary than they've ever been ever. right? So it's not really a pitch for you buying our product per se. We would love to be a part of that solution, but the reality is, like, we want to help parents fight that so that, you know, you can stay fit and healthy. Your kids are going to see that example that you're setting. They're going to see the hard work. And more important than anything is not that you use our product. It's that they get to see that hard work that you're putting in. You think about the folks that just go to the gym. They've done the hard work, but no one has seen it, right? The only people that see it are your gym folks. And it's great. It's still great for you, but from an influence on your family perspective, that's an hour to probably more like an hour and a half by the time you factor in a drive and a drive back, that you didn't share that as a leadership experience, as a bonding experience between you and your kids. So if we can bring that home, we can help parents stay fit, but we can also help you increase that time with your kids. And it's not phone time. It's not distracted time. It's, you know, you're going to get questions like, "Daddy, why are you breathing so hard? Or why are you breathing like that? Or you should do squats like this," you know, and it's some of the coolest experiences because it's so, well, it's so off the cuff, right? Like, and some of them, you know, the most fun workouts are my daughter will lead a workout and you're just like, wow, like we're doing single leg pistols on the swings and she's crushing me because, you know, she can do them. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like, how is this possible? But yeah, it's a great time. It's a lot of fun. And if it's right for somebody else and it will help you be active and with your family, then we encourage you to be aboard, you know, a part of Swing Sesh. But, you know, if it's not, more important than that is, you know, find a way to do that because it is that important. You know, later in life, you're going to feel better. You're going to be in a better spot mentally. And your ability to grandparent or to parent, whatever it is going to be higher, better, higher quality than it would have been if you kind of took that other Y in the road and you let yourself go while you're focusing on your kids.
Absolutely. So, and then
that's my pitch back.
I love it. No, it was great. It was even better than what I wanted. So it was great, man. On your website, are these kind of fully customizable? Is it kind of like can you just buy like a rack or do you have to buy like everything together? Kind of explain the process for that.
Yeah. So, well, really we're fully customizable. We offer three variants, if you will, of different sizes, but it's fully modular, fully customizable. And then I call it drop manufacturing. So we actually have some ability to fad inside of the production process. So if folks have like a specific need that they want, we can sometimes tailor things to make that happen. So, we're customizable, from, you know, a outdoor power rack all the way up to what we call the Super Sesh, which is the biggest one that we've got. And then, we have another surprise coming soon, in the next couple of weeks. We'll be pushing out a new product line and I'm looking forward to that.
Sweet. So. And then if you buy one now, you said fully customizable, but are you always going to be able to add on to it and like interchange parts? So like say in 10 years, if you're kind of what you need changes, your kid grows, you come out with something cool. Is it always going to be, have the ability to kind of add that to it with the same kind of bones of the actual product?
Yep. We went with a very standard setup so that, we could kind of keep that as the core. And then, every design that we've done has been, additive or subtractive. So you can, in any of our designs so far, we've been able to make that happen and we fully plan on keeping that because it's so important for our customer base.
Yeah. And as someone that kind of seems very driven, very motivated, do you have a long-term goal for what you want this to be? Or is it kind of just seeing where this takes you?
Well, I think we have a long-term goal. I mean, our goal is to be like, we're trying to revolutionize the playset business, right? Like there's a lot of money that goes into these playsets. There's an entire health and fitness industry. But those two things are just completely divorced, right? And what if you could bring play into the backyard and it be working out exercise, it's meeting that objective, but it's way more fun because you're playing with your family, you're outside, you're enjoying the elements, instead of treating it as sort of this other type of thing. So our goal is to continue to create this or to, you know, to build this company, into what we really think that it can be. And I think you're going to start to see that here in the next year or so. We're going to be a very common household name. So
love it, man. Congrats on everything. I think that's awesome. Go ahead right now. Obviously Swing Sesh, it's probably just swingsesh.com, but drop socials, drop whatever you want or anything you want so people can find you.
Yeah. So we're at Team Swing Sesh for Instagram. That's where most of our followers are. I'm Swing Sesh on TikTok, but I don't have anybody over there. So if you got some TikTok folks that want to come say hi, please do, because I need the love over there. And then we have Swing Sesh page on Facebook, and then we're swingsesh.com, like you said. So yeah, check us out. We'd love to have more people, just letting other folks know there's an option out there. So you don't have to stay in it. You don't have to do anything with it. You just go out and exercise and hang out with your kids.
Cool, man. I love it. Well, hey, that's all I got for you today, man. So Brad, I appreciate you coming on. We'll debrief for a minute or two once we get off, but thanks for coming on. It's been a lot of fun talking with you, and it's still crazy. Just liked a swing set page, and then here we are interviewing, talking about aviation. So you never know. Right? You never know.
I appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, anytime. Well, cool. That's a wrap on today's episode. You can check out his socials at Team Swing Sesh on Instagram, and you can go to the website swingsesh.com, check out more information about this great product. And pretty cool hearing about being a Marine pilot. I don't know much about being a Marine pilot. Like I said in this podcast, I feel like I've interviewed more Navy pilots, Army pilots, and it's great to have the Marines on. So Brad, thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it. I hope everyone enjoyed this. And as always, happy flying. Pilot to Pilot LLC is compensated to make recommendations to his or her followers regarding the services of RAA or Allworth Airline Advisors, companies of Allworth Financial, LP, or Allworth. Promoter is not an employee or investment advisor representative of Allworth. Promoter is a current client of Allworth. Allworth pays promoter a fee of $4,000 a month for sponsorship of the Pilot to Pilot podcast. Due to the compensation arrangement between Allworth and promoter has an incentive to recommend Allworth, resulting in material conflict of interest. Promoter's role on behalf of Allworth is limited strictly to making recommendations regarding the services of Allworth, introducing or referring prospective clients to Allworth. Promoter has no responsibility with respect to Allworth's investment advisor or other advisory services.